am I going to be loud enough?
You're on. It's all happening.
Okay.
Yeah, so why did you almost move to Australia?
Well, recently, as you might know, Dweezil was down there playing a series of concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't the only one who went down. My wife went, and she took two of the other kids, Amit and Diva. So the four of them were in Australia. Dweezil and Amit went first, and they were there for a few days. And they called up, and they said, "It's great here. We can breathe. The air is clean. The food is good. It's pretty." And they're really excited about it. So a few days later, Gail and Deepa got on a plane and went down there and joined them. And they started looking around for just see what, you know, what it was like down there. And I'd been twice, so I already knew that you had clean air and, you know, the rest of that stuff. So that was their big surprise. So we were seriously discussing the possibility of moving my business down there. And I told Gail to look for some property. And I made an appointment at the Australian consulate in Los Angeles to go in and talk to them to see what kind of incentives the government might offer to move a business like I have to that country. So I went there with my lawyer and walked into this room full of people waiting to immigrate, and went to the little machine and took my number, which was 38, so mm-hmm. got it upstairs and waited for a little while, went and talked with a guy. And I told him two things. I said that I was interested in moving my record company and the rest of our businesses down there. And also approached him with the idea of doing this project that I'd had in mind for a number of years, which is based on the idea of the Bauhaus in Germany,
mm-hmm.
which he wasn't familiar with, so I had to give him a quick history lesson to explain to him that between World War I and World War II, there was this thing called the Bauhaus, and people from all over the world came to Germany to work in this place, and it was an interdisciplinary art factory, I guess you could describe it, where people working in all different fields would work together, and these interesting things were the product of that. And I was trying to find out whether the Australian government would like to encourage something like that in Australia, and if in fact it was feasible to do. Well, after I had explained to him all the things that I was interested in, he began with his lecture about Australian unions. And he basically made it very clear that nothing that I ever wanted to do in life could ever be done in Australia because of your union situation. So I thanked him and left.
Mm. That's a real shame, actually.
Well, it's a fact. I mean, he told me that if I, let's say that if I were to put this institution in Australia, between the union regulations and the government regulations, I couldn't invite any craftsmen or artists from any place else in the world into Australia to work without getting union approval and government approval. They would have to do this nationwide search to find out whether or not there was somebody else who already lived in the country who couldn't do it as a job.
Yes, and if there was an equivalent,
you'd
have to take them, which is a little bit absurd, isn't it?
Yeah, but the idea of this is that you bring people from other parts of the world to interact with the people who are already in Australia so that you get some cross-pollinization of ideas and products, and the goal would be to have something that was located in Australia that would manufacture these new things there that would then be exported out.
I think you've actually just met Australia.
I just what?
You've met Australia.
I've met it. I mean, I was shocked. I had no idea when I went into that office what a horror story this man was going to tell me. And it's unfortunate. But
the union movement there is it's very reactionary.
Yeah.
That's
a mild way of what he said. That's a very, very mild version of it.
It tends to keep the place very insular, unfortunately.
I'm sure there are some good aspects to it, and I'm sure that members of the union and their leadership would probably be willing to recite all the good points of their policy for hours and hours on end. But I see that there are so many bad points to it, things that tend to hold the country back. I mean, that little lecture from the guy at the consulate explained to me in a nutshell one of the reasons why a country with the resources that you have isn't more of a world player. It can't be. You're stuck.
It's historically entrenched that way as well, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, the numbers in the unions have been going down since the Labor government got in, because there's a lot of people who aren't happy with the agreement between the unions and the government.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a slow trend away from that.
Well, based on what the guy at the consulate told me, the unions are stronger than the government still. You know,
in a sense, yes.
I mean, the government is just, you know, kind of like a show that you watch, but the real power in the country is in the hands of the unions.
It's an unofficial
union leadership.
Well, the problem with that is that the general population doesn't get, if the unions in fact control the country, that's not exactly democracy. If everybody in the country belonged to the union and you voted for the union leader, then it would in fact be a government.
Yes.
But if you have a minority that's actually controlling the government because of an economic stranglehold, that kind of disturbs the balance of a democracy, I would say.
It does. It messes it up. What it is almost is a de facto parliament, because it's a two-party state, primarily, as it is here.
Yeah.
And so if there's not terribly much to choose between the two parties.
Never has been.
That's
never
exactly
will be.
Right. Yeah. In essence, they're exactly the same. They get on very well.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone actually wants to move or to shake anything politically, what they actually have to do is foment trouble through the unions.
Have a
to
strike.
Say, yeah, we don't like this, stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And a de facto government that isn't exactly elected for that purpose is a little bit shaky.
Well, we have a problem here, not with the union. I mean, the unions can be a problem in the United States, but the problem we have is with a shadow government that was never elected by anybody. And, you know, virtually running amok.
Mm.
You don't know who these people are, except they've got one hell of a budget, and they're able to start wars, kill people, spy on people inside the country. And meanwhile, you watch what purports to be our electoral system on television, and it's shabby enough, but all this sneaky stuff that's going on behind the curtain is what's really disturbing. At least you're advanced enough in Australia that you can put your finger on it. It's union guys, you know. Here, you know, you can't, at some point, I'm sure that you couldn't be able to tell the difference between the secret government and the mafia, because they're probably cooperating from time to time.
Yes, quite conceivable, unfortunately.
Well, it seems very difficult here, the times that I've been here, to get any information at all about what's going on in the world. It's really difficult if you don't have...
Well, you have to call me, because I'll find a way to find out. I mean, that's my hobby,
great.
Is trying to find out what's really going on out there, you know. But call me up. I'll give you the bad news anytime you want.
That's what I want, please. I feel like I've been cut
off. It's hard enough for a citizen here, based on, you know, the amount of media that's available in this country. You'd think you'd be able to tell at a glance what the world situation is, but you really have to work at it.
Well, people I've spoken to here say that they listen to Radio Australia.
Yeah.
And that's one way that they get their information.
That's good. I can't get Radio Australia.
Yeah, I haven't found out how to get it here, but apparently you can. So.
It's interesting, the first point that you made about moving to Australia, because it was going to be a question of mine that I was wondering. I was wondering whether you had actually considered it, because it seems like a sensible move in so many ways.
Well, we considered it a couple of times, but the reason that we were considering it seriously now is because the kids went there, they saw it, and they liked it. You know, and I mean, you haven't really seen my house. You haven't seen what kind of a facility we have here with the studio and everything. It would be a major, major undertaking to try and relocate this even two blocks away, let alone move it to another country.
Right. Couple of 747s.
Easily. Maybe those big Russian planes that you have down there.
Right.
We understand that you've set up a company called Why Not.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what the service is that company offers, and how Australian businesses or individuals could use that service?
It's a Delaware corporation chartered to do licensing, consulting, and social engineering. And as far as the Australian businessman taking advantage of the service, it already appears to me, based on an interview that I conducted with the chargé d'affaires at the Australian embassy in Moscow, that there's plenty of business already set up between Australia and the Soviet Union. He told I interviewed him in January, And he told me about this spaceport project that you have.
Uh-huh.
And this had never appeared in any U.S. news at all. And, you know, I thought I had this fabulous scoop. And I was doing these interviews for Financial News Network. And I came back, and FNN wouldn't run it. And finally, the story broke 6 months later. I guess it was June or July when the first mention of the Australian spaceport appeared on CNN. But, you know, I'd known about it for some time. One of the things that I've tried to do with my company is I meet a lot of people and find out a lot of things, and I remember them. And every once in a while, somebody calls me up and they've got a product or a problem, and I'll figure out where you might go to get something done or who you might talk to to expedite something.
Was that tractor business done through you, done through your company?
Well, I haven't been able to help them yet. I've tried and tried, and you're talking about the Jack Tractor, which is a joint venture between a company in Vermont and an Australian company. And I think the Tractor is really a very interesting and good product. The videotape that I saw of the thing is spectacular. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen it?
No, I haven't.
It's a little tractor that runs on very little fuel, and it can pick up a 2,000-pound log with this device underneath of it. You can't tip the damn thing over. It's got a special mechanism where all the wheels are independently balanced, and it just has much better performance specs than any normal kind of a tractor.
Mm-hmm.
And the price is low, and as I said, it runs on very little fuel, and it's an ideal tool to use in third world nations. I mean, they could use a slew of these things in the Soviet Union.
They could use a lot of things. So.
Yeah. But, you know, now that they're giving the farmers their land back, this is the kind of a tool that an individual farmer could use to great advantage to work his plot. And it's the kind of thing that right now the Soviets have several hundred military factories that they're willing to convert to the manufacture of consumer goods. And the problem is that not too many Western joint venture partners want to go in there because the political situation is so unstable. But the fact is that in these military factories, that's where all the good labor is.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you had a product, for example, if I could somehow convince somebody to finance the manufacture of this tractor in the Soviet Union, if the labor is as good as I think it is in these plants that used to make tanks and so forth, if they can make good tractors, not only can you have them to help the Soviet agriculture, but you can send these outside the country as an export product and make hard currency for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of business that they need there, is expertise that will convert their old factories to manufacture things that they can sell elsewhere that they can make cash for.
Hmm.
You know, you can't just keep them alive by shipping them plane loads of food periodically. You know, you have to find some way to help them straighten out their own industry.
Hmm. Yeah, well, they keep talking about Gorbachev, you know, how long he's going to last and all that sort of thing. I keep hearing that here, you know.
Well, that's the... there's a whole subspecies of cold warrior that refuses to die in American politics and in American business. And there's a lot of the older guys that are up sitting in the boardrooms of major U.S. companies that refuse to admit that the Cold War is over. And any chance they get to hang on to some remnant of U.S. versus Soviet Union kind of mentality, they'll do it. And this attitude is often reflected in articles in the Wall Street Journal. I mean, that's the place where you see it most often. Every time that there's some kind of a plenum or something that they're voting on in the Soviet Union, you will get a big article in the Wall Street Journal saying, he's going down. This is, you know, they're going to get him this time. And then the next day, you know, he waves magic wand and he gets what he wants over there. I mean, it's very odd that he's been able to survive this long considering how bad conditions actually are inside the country. But on the other hand, I think that even though the Russian citizens complain a lot about Gorbachev, there really isn't a replacement for him. I can't see Yeltsin taking over his role in world diplomacy. Yeltsin may be okay to run the Russian Republic. He's very charismatic. They have big rallies for him. He's very popular and everything, but I don't see him getting the Nobel Peace Prize anytime soon.
What's your opinion about the trade war that appears to be developing between the U.S. and Europe?
How about between the U.S. and the rest of the world? I think that the problem is that these same people, these short-sighted people who happen to run things around here, refuse to admit that some of the problems that we have in this country economically are our own fault. And a lot of it can be traced back to the policies of the Reagan administration, where cash for education is cut, cash for social services is cut, and the underpinnings of the economy started crumbling. Where a few people made a lot of money on Wall Street and all the, you know, the go-go stuff that went on during the 80s, the basic machinery that holds the society up and guarantees it a future was just smashed. Mm-hmm. Now, how can you have, look into the future, you don't even need a crystal ball for this, but how do you compete in the 90s when, as I've said before, the real weapon of World War III is going to be the cash register? Mm-hmm. You can't compete in an international market with a totally uneducated population. The bulk of the people in this country can't read, can't write, and can't do arithmetic. They can play video games. They will go out and buy just about anything you stick in front of them. Of course, they're buying it on credit.
Yeah, that's a real worry.
So you're suggesting there's a society of undereducated consumers. Willing consumers.
That's right. And I think that some people like it that way because the dumber they are, the easier it is to hand them candidates like Bush and Quayle. Mm. And, I mean, this is the country where the guy with the most balloons wins. Mm-hmm. That's all. If you've ever watched a U.S. political campaign around president time, it's just, it's about balloons.
It's an embarrassment, actually.
It is.
It's scary.
But if the total population is so stupid that they don't even know that they're embarrassing, then it's like living in dreamland, you know? I mean, the most of the people in this country are so culturally illiterate and just basically deprived of necessary information that they don't even know how much trouble they're in. And if you tell them, they get upset about it, and the first instinct is always to blame it on somebody else, and it's always easier to blame it on somebody who has either a different complexion than yours or some different facial characteristics, and we're moving into a whole period of the rebirth of Japan bashing and every other kind of bashing that you can imagine.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
Yes. It's become quite apparent here, actually, to me.
When really who ought to get bashed is the Republican Party, because, of course, they had a little help from the Democrats who allowed them to get away with all this stuff, but all the bad policies were Republican inventions. Mm. I mean, these are the people, the real cold warriors, is the whole core of the Republican Party.
Mm. You know, we were talking about this before. It seems like that a lot of the real assholes have come out of the woodwork since Reagan got in.
Well, like they say, water seeks its own level, and I guess the assholes do too. Mm-hmm. He was a magnet, you know, to bring assholes to his side. Well, not only did they love him, they helped put him in office. Reagan was put in office by this coalition of fundamentalist Christian organizations. Pat Robertson, who ran for president the last time around, was one of the people who was instrumental in putting Reagan in office. The story about when Reagan decided to run, he was in Southern California at a prayer meeting holding hands with Robertson and a few other guys, you know, and the Lord came down and revealed to these men that Reagan should run the country and, you know, move everybody that much closer to Armageddon.
You've said in interviews that politics is the entertainment branch of industry.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that? Can you elaborate?
Well, while you're looking at these buffoons on C-SPAN and on the nightly news, the real business of running the world is actually being conducted by businesses. Mm.
Military-industrial complex.
Yes. They sort of tolerate these political buffoons, and, you know, sometimes they have to work through them in order to get some of their desires taken care of. But without the assistance of the industrial base, nobody's government will work. Mm. We have to be candid about it, you know. There is just a certain amount of showmanship that, especially U.S. politics, it's, you know.
Yeah,
it's a joke.
So many balloons.
Yeah, such a wild circus extravaganza.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the most horrific things I've ever witnessed was these hearings about the Persian Gulf that have been going on in Congress. Mm-hmm. The Senate side has their hearings. The House of Representatives has their hearings. They bring in experts, military experts and former secretaries of state and so on and so forth to give them answers about what's really going to happen in the Persian Gulf. And I watched about 2 hours of testimony in the House of Representatives the other night. And I have never seen such a collection of mediocre minds and these congressmen asking questions. You couldn't believe the questions they were asking in all seriousness and redundant. I mean, each guy would ask a different version of the same question, never deal with the answer. And basically it was like, well, when we go to war, how many people will die? You know, it was all just variations on that. And this one guy who believed that he had it all figured out, I can't remember what his name was, some non-entity congressman from Ohio, believed that all this talk about extreme losses of life could be solved very easily if we just bombed everything, and you don't have to send those guys in on the ground. And he was talking to these military planners saying, yeah, I don't understand, why do we have to send soldiers in to risk their lives? Well, we can just use our air power and win this war.
Yeah, and they should have won in Vietnam.
Yeah, bomb them back to the Stone Age. So anyway, this military advisor very mildly looks at this man and says, well, one of the ways that you know that you win a war is when there's a soldier standing on a certain piece of land holding his rifle and no one shoots at him. And the guy couldn't get it. He couldn't get it. Why do we have to send people? How are you going to know you liberated Kuwait? What are you going to do? But the real question is, why would we liberate Kuwait? Why would we be helping this family of 1,200? That's the Kuwaitis. That's the Sabah family. If you're not in that family, you can't even really be a Kuwaiti. Mm-hmm. You don't get citizenship. I believe they haven't even signed that one part of the UN treaty that abolishes slavery.
Yeah, I believe it not.
They had slavery up there until 30 years ago.
Yeah, they were one of the richest countries in the world with virtually no social security system.
No, you have slavery, no, you know, what do you need social security for? You know, I just find it difficult to understand why we would be so willing to spend all this money and endanger all those lives to go in there to protect the rights of this particular royal family. I don't get it.
It is unusual, isn't it?
Yeah.
To stand on a principle is sometimes interesting in itself, but there are so many principles unstood for. Why this one?
Yeah, this is a very interesting principle to stand for. And then when they start talking about, well, it's just about aggression. You know, the very idea that somebody would just go charging into somebody else's country. And wait a minute, yesterday was the first anniversary of Operation Just Cause, when we went blasting into Panama to arrest their president. For what? So we can stick him in jail and tape his conversations? This is truly government by the most balloons. And when they let those balloons fly away, I worry. You know why? Because there's more intelligence in each of those balloons than in the people who are left on the ground.
I thought scaring Noriega out of his quarters with lots of Western rock music was probably the
Welcome to the Jungle is the thing that they played. And CNN is showing pictures of these earnest-looking government disc jockeys with their earphones on, cranking up the volume on Welcome to the Jungle. Boy, that really did. That's psychological warfare, huh?
Yeah, at its meanest, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yes. Yeah. Just within the Geneva Convention, I should imagine.
What do you think the real reason for the golf crisis is? What's the real motivation?
I think it has a lot to do with, as James Baker III once said, jobs. I mean, that may be the only honest thing the man has said all week or all month, and then regretted saying it. Mm-hmm. And there's two ways to look at the question of jobs. One guy that I saw on C-SPAN was pointed out something rather clever. We're at the point now where we're supposed to bring back several hundred thousand guys from the NATO forces that we don't need over there anymore. We're going to bring them home. Mm-hmm. To what? Where will they work? There's no jobs for them when they get back. So what is about jobs? If you send them to the Persian Gulf, they got a job anyway.
Either that or half of them will be killed.
That's right. Yeah, but the really grim thing to think about is this. You know, temperature's 120 degrees, right? Here comes the poison gas. Everybody puts on the rubber suit. Okay, now figure it out. They're saving on body bags here, you know? Because once you put that suit on, you can't take it off. Because you got nothing to rinse the stuff off with.
Exactly.
So it's like a boil-in bag kind of cadaver situation.
Cooks in its own juice.
That's right. And, you know, the idea that you can tell these soldiers, hey, this stuff works, you know, just put on the suit, you'll be okay. It's ludicrous.
Mm-hmm.
But we must balance this off against this one important concept. This is a volunteer army.
Yeah.
These guys joined. Now, if it was a draft, it would have been a completely different thing.
Mm.
The whole situation in the U.S. would be very different right now.
Mm.
And I don't think the anti-war sentiment will really heat up in this country until they try and do a draft. Now, can you imagine all these people who are out there with their boom boxes and the rest of that stuff? It's not like, you know, trying to draft people during the Vietnam era. The teenagers in this country have mutated into something entirely different and literally undraftable. They can't read, they can't write. You're going to stick them in one of those high-tech whatchamacallits and tell them to go run it?
Yeah, they can't even read the instruction manual.
They can't. You know, and what, I can't wear my gold chains when I go over there? What am I going to do?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting concept, the fact that stupidity in the society actually makes the war machine redundant, because you're unable to deal with that many consumers who are only good at being consumers.
Well, I've said in my book that the reason why there was never going to be a war between the superpowers is that if anybody ever tried to bomb this country, that the Japanese would come in right away to protect us, because if we're gone, who's buying their stuff? I mean, the same goes for everybody else who manufactures products. I mean, it's going to get to the point where we won't be able to manufacture anything here. We'll be totally dependent for stuff on the rest of the world. We won't even be able to make our own stuff. We're barely capable now of reading the instructions that come with the stuff. And most of the people don't read them anyway. They just piddle around with this stuff until they can make it work. Like, you know, the joke about the 12 o'clock on the on the VCR. Everybody's got a 12 o'clock on the VCR because they don't know how to set it. You know? Nobody ever read the instruction book.
Flashing away.
That's right. It tells you something.
How can people get the information they need to make an educated, informed vote when the media is so full of disinformation?
Well, the problem is that there's nobody to vote for, you know. I mean, if there's no good candidates, all the information in the world isn't really going to help you, is it?
Well, what would be the point in voting if
that's... Well, that's the problem that I've arrived at now. I mean, after years of, you know, urging people to register to vote and being, you know, pushing for all this stuff, the amount of time that I've spent in the last few months watching C-SPAN, and for Australian listeners who don't know what that is, there's a cable, what is it? Cable Satellite Public Affairs Network is what it stands for, and there's two C-SPAN channels. C-SPAN 1 is the House of Representatives, and C-SPAN 2 is the Senate. And on a daily basis, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you can watch your government in action live. And when the Houses of Congress are not in session, you can watch committee hearings and speeches and the rest of the stuff. And if you want to spend the time, you can see all of the news events full length that the national news cuts down to 10 seconds. You can find out everything that they left out. And that's one of the things that I do. I make a habit of watching that just to see what
really
happened.
I didn't know that existed. That sounds better.
Oh, it's very interesting. But it can be deceptive, too, because, when the Congress isn't in session and they have to fill up the airtime with other events, they have, you know, certain propaganda-type events that get on their speeches about this and that. So some of that you have to watch out for, but they have some very good features, like these call-in shows where they'll bring in a congressman or senator or some other public figure, and he'll sit there and he'll answer questions, and they'll take phone calls from around the world. And there have been some interesting things on those shows. And the other thing that I like to watch is they have guest speakers at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., come and talk about various things. And the two most interesting recent speeches that I saw was Peter Grace. Do you know who he is? Know what the Grace Commission was during the Reagan administration?
I've heard of the Grace Commission, but I can't place it.
Well, Reagan tasked this guy, conservative guy, in the early days of the Reagan administration to compile a report to define where the waste and fraud was in the government, and they were going to go after it. Remember that?
Yeah.
Like, you know,
yeah.
2,000-page report or something like that, which was never acted on. And here's this guy, he's in his 60s or 70s, and he's violent, livid, he's screaming at this, you know, delivering this speech and ranting and exhorting everybody, going back over the things that were originally contained in this 1983 report. And when it came out, the report said that if you did these couple of hundred things that were listed in the report, you could save $434 billion off of the budget. And nobody did anything. And the arguments against it were, this is all pie in the sky. You know, the maximum amount of savings that could be gained wouldn't be more than $2 or $3 billion. And, you know, all these arguments and on and on and on. Well, he took just one thing out of the report. He said, remember, the original report said you could have saved $434 billion. One of the things that they suggested at that time was to charge lending institutions like savings and loans and banks and all the rest of that. Their charge for this federal deposit insurance should be based on how strong the institution was. Now, if they would have enacted that in 1983, we wouldn't have what we have now. He said, just if you would have done that, we would have saved $500 billion. And he was ranting on it. It was really a good speech. The other thing that was fabulous was, you know who Gennady Gerasimov is? Well, he's been the Soviet spokesman for Glasnost and Perestroika for the last 4.5 years. Very good English. And, you know, he's not the guy who travels with Gorbachev. He's the one who does all the talk shows and answers all the questions.
I do know who he is. Yeah, he's been around to our country making jokes.
Yeah. Well, I like this guy. I think that, you know, he did a lot to help create trust between U.S. viewers and the Soviet Union, just because most of the people who had been on the air prior to him representing Soviet point of view didn't have his style and weren't in possession of the kind of answers that he has given. I mean, what I've seen is you can ask this guy anything and you get a straight answer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, usually, not always things that makes the Soviet Union look good. He just, you know, blurts it right out. And so he has been reassigned. He's no longer going to have that position. And so they had him speaking at the National Press Club. Well, it was the most poorly attended event that I had ever seen televised. There was like 10 or 15 people in the audience. And he looked, you know, beat, he looked depressed, and the thing came on, and they gave him some paltry little award, and it was like, why are they even broadcasting this? And I thought, this is going to be a truly remarkable show.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he did like 3 or 4 minutes of opening remarks and said, okay, any questions? And there was this big silence, like, you know, there was nothing was going to happen. So one by one, these cards started coming up and they started asking him questions. Well, because there was no rush, he was giving these very long, very detailed answers to all kinds of stuff about Soviet politics. And it was the most informative show that I've seen on that subject in a long time. He went on for about, you know, 45 minutes or an hour with these things. And I learned a lot, like about this food crisis that they have over there now. Mm. Well, are you aware of how the food crisis in Moscow came about?
No.
Well, somebody in the government decided that in order to make sure we're not going to have any problems here during this winter, that you can only shop in a Moscow store if you show the storekeeper an identity card that says you live in Moscow. Well, all right. Sounds good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wrong. Moscow is surrounded by all these little townlets that make the butter, the eggs, all the rest of the stuff, and they can't shop in town, so they stop sending the food in.
Mm-hmm.
So the people in Moscow are surrounded by all these people who are keeping the eggs, they're keeping the butter, they're keeping the chickens, and it's not going into the store because somebody said you can't shop unless you show the card. So these farmers just said, okay, squat on this. Now, did you ever see that on the news? No, that's what happened. So it's not even a matter of bringing in foodstuffs from thousands of miles away.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of changing a few regulations right there in Moscow, and you might be able to avoid some of the food shortages this winter. Situation in Leningrad's slightly different, but you know, just because I tuned in and watched something that looked like it was going to be a boring show, that was only one of the really interesting things that I found out. So you can get information here, you just have to know where to look for it. Mm.
Well, that would indicate that they have some problems in that case, because they'd have to get away from a fundamental stupidity. So, that could be a real problem.
Where, you're talking about in the Soviet Union?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know whether that's really a stupidity on the part of the farmers. I think that's rather smart.
Not on the part of the farmers, but
the stupidity, that stupidity is the nature of communism. Mm. You see, for 70 years, one guy in a central planning agency goes, these shoes will be made. It doesn't matter if they don't fit, nobody wants to buy them. You're making shoes, buddy.
Yes, they're all right foots.
That's right. And they're all brown, and there it is. I mean, somebody decides, and you didn't get to vote for him, you didn't get to install him, and you can't fire him.
Mm.
And so as long as you have a situation where incompetence can be perpetuated, that can happen to anybody. I mean, you know, you probably got your own version of that in Australia.
We certainly have.
So the real problem that Gorbachev is facing is not just that everything in the country mechanically is falling apart, but the basic rules and regulations of their economic system don't quite work. Never did.
Yes, the infrastructure's there, but it doesn't work. And
well, the infrastructure's there, but it's beat. And the people who are working in the infrastructure are totally unmotivated, but the whole brains of the operation, the central planning, that's what's got to go. Now, if you take it away, what do you replace it with? Anarchy? Because these people have lived with central planning for 70 years. You can't just turn a switch and turn it off. And you can't just turn a switch and say, okay, now you have free enterprise and you can own things. Because before the communists came in, certain people already owned things, and they want them back. Mm. That's happening in Hungary, it's happening in Czechoslovakia. All the families that own castles, big tracts of land, they're going, all right, you're getting rid of communism, I want my land back.
Mm.
And if they get it back, they're going to be, you know, like, one example, there's this guy who would be the king of Czechoslovakia now.
Mm-hmm.
If you give him his land back. I mean, he is literally entitled to be the king of Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, certain logistical problems.
From communism to a monarchy, I think, is a bit of a quantum leap.
It is. But, you know, there are some people who would like it better that way. In the case of Czechoslovakia, for example, this particular guy who is in line to be the king happens to be a really nice guy who spent most of the time not being a king working on human rights. And, you know, he'd make a pretty good king. And from a tourist standpoint, if they had a monarchy, can you imagine? You know, okay, we're going to have a king now. We're going from the type of Czechoslovakia that we've known for all those years to
a place with castles, king, big coronation ceremony.
Yeah. That
wouldn't hurt their tourist business. And if you look at what tourism brings to a country, Austria, which is right next door, does $20 billion a year in tourism alone. Mm. Now, the only way that you're going to get an infusion of $20 billion in Czechoslovakia is through tourism, because I can't see somebody walking in there and putting $20 billion into the Czech shoe factory. That's not going to happen. They get more bang for their buck by building up their tourism infrastructure, and the country is competitive with Austria in terms of the type of tourism that goes on there, because Austria has like concert halls and all this artistic and historic type tourism. You know, it's a very romantic thing. Czechoslovakia's got all that.
Mm-hmm. I've heard it's a very pretty place, actually.
Yeah.
What are the chances then that they'll install a silent monarchy, as it were, along the lines of the English monarchy?
Well, I don't know. I'd give it 50-50 if I was lobbying it. You know, I think you could make a pretty good case for it if you laid it out in economic terms. You know, like, what does it hurt? If you get a king, you got some castles, you have the coronation, you do all of that stuff, he's a nice guy, he's already done good work in terms of human rights all over the place. This is an interesting king. This is a king that can do interviews.
Yeah.
It can't hurt. What are you going to lose by doing this?
True. It's hardly a return to feudalism if he's a silent monarch.
Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting idea.
And so the same thing is possible for Hungary, too. They have a royal family there, too.
Yeah, well, I can't imagine King of Australia, so...
Well, I could, if you were creative. Do Paul Hogan.
King Bob.
Yeah, King Bob. Do you think people today are more willing to censor themselves than they were, say, 10 years ago? You know, are they wimpier about saying what they think?
In this country.
Since the beginning of the Reagan era?
In this country, no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
Statistically, the size of the... testicular equipment of the average person in the United States has just shriveled down to, I mean, we're down to nanometers.
Yeah.
Oh, so testicular atrophy is the measure there.
That's what it is.
What do you think that might be?
Why?
Yeah.
Because the reason why people are afraid to speak out is because of the types of punishments that can be heaped on you. You know,
mm-hmm.
Basically, you can lose everything that you've worked for. You can be poor. You can go to jail. You can be punished. You can be hurt.
Mm. Well, there's certainly
it's been not just that somebody will raise their eyebrow at you.
Yeah.
They'll stick you in jail.
Yeah, we'll shoot you.
Would you be suggesting that is partly to do with the fact that you have a secret arm of government that's pretty much running around getting the dirt on people?
No.
Blackmailing them?
No. That's all... Well, we have to thank J. Edgar Hoover for that. I think that you know what Mount Rushmore is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. With the famous faces carved in there. I suggest we have a real Mount Rushmore with the people who really shaped this country. It should be J. Edgar Hoover. Definitely. For sure. Joe McCarthy. Joe McCarthy got to be in there.
Mm.
Ed Meese.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I hate Mises to pieces.
Yeah, and I think those three are really... Reagan, yeah, you can stick him in there just, you know, for tourist value. But the people who have really done the damage are those guys.
Mm. Well, what do you say to the idea of many people that graphic sex or violence will cause people to be violent?
Well, I don't think that graphic sex causes people to be sexy.
Mm-hmm.
And graphic violence doesn't necessarily cause people to be violent. I would say that statistically you could argue that if you showed graphic violence to, say, 1,000 people, that maybe 5 of them would become violent, but they would become violent anyway.
Mm.
And if you showed graphic sex to 1,000 people, then maybe 5 of them would be graphically doing stuff, but, you know...
Mm. Well, I ask this question because there seems to be a movement, a new Puritanism in Australia. And Well, it seems to be the case here, too.
Well, I think that that may be the curse of English-speaking people.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I've always been concerned about is the way in which religious organizations who are evangelical send missionaries to different lands and inflict a version of U.S. foreign policy or moral policy on people who absolutely don't need it, would be much better off without it, and wind up being tricked into adopting these attitudes and buying into these theories because of the way the missionary work is conducted. You know, in third world countries, the guy comes in with a little, some milk, some rice, and some penicillin, but you don't get the treatment unless you're going to read the Bible, and by the time you're done, you're a zombie.
Yeah, that's disgusting.
Well, some governments have tried to keep the missionaries out, but oftentimes, given the choice between having, they'll wink their eye if somebody's going to come in with the medicine, and let them do a little evangelizing on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And we find this in the Soviet Union right now. There are a lot of, this is a growth field for a lot of U.S. evangelicals are going in there now because they've allowed religious freedom, and the Russian people generally are very spiritual and tend to like religion anyway. We have this freeze-dried Western Christianity that is coming in there, and eventually it's going to pose some sort of a threat to the Orthodox Church, and it's going to create problems.
Mm-hmm. I believe you met one of our own type of missionaries once in Australia, Fred Nile. Do you remember ever meeting him?
No.
Okay, he was the equivalent of, like, Mary Whitehouse.
Who is that? I don't know who Mary
Whitehouse.
No.
Oh, okay. Well, she was campaigning for many years and is probably still campaigning in Britain to sort of stop any kind of thing related to sex on television.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Anyway, I believe that Fred Nile, who is now a senator in the New South Wales Parliament, back in 1973 campaigned, according to my information, to stop you from coming into our country. You know, and apparently he confronted you, but you know, if you don't,
that's not true.
No?
No. I have no knowledge of anything like this ever taking place. I mean, you know, somebody might have campaigned to keep me out of the country before I got there, but I certainly got there.
Yeah, you did.
And I've never been, I have no recollection of ever having an argument with you know, somebody of that was trying to do that. I mean,
okay.
I would have stuck it in the book if I had.
What can the average person do? Say works 5-6 days a week, has a family, do about censorship or the parlous state of politics, even if he cared about it?
Well, I think it's gotten beyond the point where, you know, I would say just be careful who you vote for. I think more of these average guys who work 5 and 6 days a week ought to run for something. I mean, we got a problem here where the people who are running for office in the U.S. are think of themselves as professional politicians, you know. Mm-hmm. They all have advisors, and we've gotten pretty far away from the idea of a representational form of government where, you know, the public actually gets represented, because it costs so much to get elected. There's only a certain species of individual who can stand there with the balloons going off behind them and say all those platitudes and have his hair fixed like that and be that kind of non-entity that it takes to get elected.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be that kind of a guy in order to get the big bucks from the donors who, you know, the Keatings of this world, who will put up money to elect a candidate like that. Meanwhile, anybody, any regular guy who might like old-fashioned democracy is mm-hmm. pretty much squeezed out of the system here. I don't know what it's like in Australia, what the costs are to run a campaign and to get elected. But I think we've just about reached the end of the rope in the United States because, to give you an example, Nixon's presidential campaign cost about $25 million. Alan Cranston's senatorial campaign the last time cost about $20 million, like the cost of the whole nation campaign versus the cost of a state campaign. You can just see how everything is just skyrocketed.
Mm-hmm.
And because it costs so much to run, the minute you're in, you're doing nothing but fundraising. There's no time to do any government. And the type of people who have gotten into the Congress in the United States, I mean, there are a few guys that I've seen on there that I think are smart, and I'm glad they're in there. I don't want to make the whole U.S. Congress not to be a bunch of bad guys, but the bulk of them are just dorks, just idiots, misfits, and they couldn't get a job anyplace else. And it's just appalling to watch them, and they're writing the laws of this country. They're not only writing the laws, but their vote counts when it comes time to decide which of the laws are enacted. So one of the things that they say about the United States is it's a nation of laws. But I always say it's a nation of laws, badly written and randomly enforced. And at that, when you have that situation, you really don't have any law. Where is the incentive for anybody to be a quote-unquote law-abiding citizen when you look at the laws and the laws are idiotic? Because the trend today is to pass any old kind of law, whether or not you believe it will stand up to a Supreme Court test, because it may never get to the Supreme Court because it costs a lot of money to challenge a law and take it to the Supreme Court. So you have the books are riddled with laws that are not constitutional, but there's such a huge backlog of things that would have to be decided by the Supreme Court, and if it ever gets there, you have a Supreme Court that is stacked by right-wing guys. So the chances of having anything that resembles fairness and an even-handed law policy for the entire country, forget it.
Yeah, that's pretty bleak. Okay. Did you
have don't let it happen in your country, okay?
It is.
It is?
Yeah. It is.
Well, you know, I wish there was some way to warn you guys. I mean, you know, you already got that union problem, and if you can't deal with that, then, you know, why should you even worry about the government when the union's running your country?
The problem in Australia is that we're in a transition now. We have been for about since the 60s. We're an English country, primarily, who gave up on England, and we are now following the American example in every way that's possible. In politics in particular, everything that you were saying about the fundraising aspect is becoming more and more evident, and everything's going down the gurgler.
That's a good expression. Well, let me tell you, there's two things that I would avoid. One is the British example, and the other one is the American example.
Yes.
Now, what I would prefer is for you guys to invent yourselves rather than choosing these two rather incompetent models. I mean, why would anybody who purports to be a nominally intelligent being look at either of those models and say, that's the thing for me? I mean, Britain is a disaster.
It's the very thing that freaks our country out, I think, having to do anything by itself.
Originality. Mediocrity is the key to our success and failure.
All right, let me tell you why you guys are ahead of the game, okay? You know why we have problems here? Because we were founded by religious fanatics. The people that founded this country were the dregs of the religious world of England. I mean, they were happy to be rid of those idiots who got on the Mayflower and came over here. Get those suckers out of here. So the fanatics came and they founded this country. You had it better. You had real criminals. Criminals, people who could do things with their hands, you know? So you're already ahead.
The one thing that killed it for us, I think, is that alcohol was the first unit of currency in Australia.
Yeah.
And it is still the secondary unit of currency in the general
population.
Well,
when you have a country that will even consider a product such as alcoholic milk, not too many other countries in the world would think of a consumer product such as alcoholic milk. Yeah. Well, this adds a whole new dimension to Rice Krispies.
That's right.
Do we look at it?
We're very original in that regard.
That's original. That's original.
You can get alcohol in anything. You can get it in books. I mean, you just have to inject it into the paper. It'll stick somewhere.
Well, you know, I think I'd rather see that. I'd rather see a nation of people walking around alcohol saturated than a nation of people walking around clutching Bibles and referring to the Bible before they perform any body functions.
Amen.
You know, this at least you can understand why somebody is going to drink. You can't understand why people would want to go the fundamentalist route and have their whole lives guided by the text in a book that has been published in so many different versions, you don't know what was originally intended in there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how many different versions of the Bible can there be? There's like hundreds of them, and each new one is made even simpler to understand. This is the goal of the Bible publishing industry.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the original racy passages have been removed. You know, we don't want to know what's really going on in the Song of Solomon when that guy stuffs his fist inside that woman. We don't want to know about that. So we're going to leave that out, and we're going to make the word smaller and smaller and smaller. And then there's the picture version, then there's picture with talk balloons. I mean, people willing to have their entire existence guided by the good book. But the good book has already been modified by some guy in a silk suit who's found yet another way to take this basic text, rehash it, and put out this year's version of the Bible. Every year there's two or three new editions.
Yes. And people who are of that sort of bent simply search for a reinterpretation. Once they find one that suits them, then of course that's the only true one.
I know, and then they're ready to kill anybody who doesn't agree with their book. So I think it's not bad that you have a nation where they will have alcoholic milk on their Rice Krispies. That's not too weird. That's not too weird.
Or beer with the cornflakes in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's been dark. Are the religious right any less powerful now than prior to the Jim Bakker scandal?
I would say that their influence has gone down maybe 20 or 30%. It looks like it's gone down more because they're not on TV as much doing the same things that they did during the Reagan administration. But what they've done is they've changed tactics. And this was even announced in a Wall Street Journal article several years ago where they said that what they're going to do now is they're going to run for school boards. It's a matter of infiltration, you know. Instead of going on TV and doing all their religious / real estate scams, they are infecting the society at every level. You know, born again Christians, those people with a fish on the back of the car, they're on the school board, they're in the city council, they're in every little place where they can go, and they're like, you ever seen Night of the Living Dead, that movie?
No, I haven't.
Well, like zombies, you can't stop them. The only way to stop them is you have to blow their brains out.
Yeah. When I've driven around and I've seen those people with a fish on the back of the cars, I've almost thought, well, I'd almost rather be behind somebody on drugs than somebody that kind of out of it.
Well, it's the same. You know, sometimes we really have to worry when you see the fish and a bumper sticker that says, "Beam me up, Jesus." Have you seen that one?
Yeah.
And if those two things are on the back of a Volvo, then you're in trouble because you're the one that's going to die and they're going to survive.
Oh, yeah.
This is a slightly different question here. Your book was dedicated to Stephen Hawking and Coco.
Yeah.
We know who Stephen Hawking is.
Coco is that gorilla that had the pet cat. You know, there's the experiments that were done with this gorilla named Coco. She could communicate.
She made up
words. They had a little machine for her to push things and... And they gave her a kitten, which she named All Ball.
Really?
Yeah. And the kitten died. And you know, there's some stuff in the newspaper when Coco's kitten died. So it's, you know, Coco can read. Coco can have some communication with the outside world. So, you know, one of these days, I hope Coco gets around to my book.
All right. Edmund Cohen, in his book The Mind of the Bible Believer, mentions that you, Jared Straub, Waleed Ali, and himself plan to produce and market a video talking about Pat Robinson and his super Christian dystopia. Is that still in the pipeline?
Well, no, we're not going to do it. It's been videotaped. We have the And I got all of them together in my studio, and we had this interesting conversation. But I don't think there's much chance that the production on that project will ever be completed and will ever be released, because I don't think there's enough interest in it. Mm.
What are the pajama people of today wearing?
Gold chains.
Uh-huh.
You have a rag around your head, then a hat on top of the rag.
What's that? You haven't seen that one? That is.
You know, they can wear anything, you know. If they're in the recording studio, they're wearing clothes with diagonal zippers. Space clothes.
Oh, yeah, right.
I was wondering if perhaps some of their other organs corresponded diagonally internally. I just never asked.
Could be.
Okay. I saw an episode of the Freeman Report where you were being interviewed.
You may be the only person on the planet who saw that. You know why? Because when it was done, that show used to run on CNN. If you did that interview, it would be run twice. And it was run in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they didn't like what I said, so they buried the show.
Well, that was a good interview.
And the way they buried it was, they ran it at the same time as we were doing a live MTV broadcast on Halloween of 1981.
Uh-huh. Right.
So interesting, it was buried. I have a copy of the tape. I thought it was a good interview, too.
Mm.
But, I mean, if you look at that now and you see some of the things that I was saying about Reagan, nobody would say that stuff about Reagan at that time. And CNN has always been a very Republican kind of a network, as far as I'm concerned. And
yes, that's reasonably evident.
And, you know, very supportive of any Republican administration. So I'm surprised they even interviewed me to begin with, but, you know, it's not so surprising that they buried the
Perhaps
thing.
They were testing their own powers.
Yeah.
Well, in that interview, anyway, unfortunately, we missed the answers to some of the last questions. She asked a question, was there anything happening which would give you any reason for optimism in any field?
God, I can't remember what I answered on that. I could probably get out the tape and find it, but, you know.
Well, do you see anything now that would give you any optimism?
Well, I would say that I was more optimistic before this Persian Gulf stuff broke out, because with all the changes in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, I would say that anybody who'd followed politics for the last 40 years would have to say, hey, something good is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem with the Persian Gulf is that it's disrupting focus on all those democratic changes in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, because when people get focused on war and you know, all the other paraphernalia that you look on CNN, it's like commercials for different types of murder appliances. Ah, look what we could do to them with this one, you know, and that kind. We don't have to worry because we have this air power and these smart bombs, and, you know, just your brain wants to explode when it looks at that stuff. And
it's advertising.
Yeah, it is advertising. Mm-hmm. So that part is depressing, but I still think that if you're going to be optimistic about anything, you have to be optimistic about what could happen when the East Bloc starts moving toward not just democracy, but moving toward a better economic situation, because there's a lot of skilled and talented people who have been living under this stupid economic system for all these years, and they need to intermingle with the rest of the people in the world. There needs to be more interaction. In my trips to the Soviet Union, one of the things that impressed me is the people that I met there were so fantastic. And I thought, if we had just been working with these people for 40 years instead of planning on how to blow them up, we would be in so much better shape.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Russians were unbelievable.
Well, they're still talking about ideas over there like they mean something.
That's true.
Mm. Yes, the idealism is almost childlike to read it from the Western perspective.
Yeah.
Because we're so, well, I am so cynical.
Well, it's it's not exactly that way, though, because you have to understand that the Russians and the spiritualism that they have is something vastly different than Western mentality of spiritualism. And they've really got something. They're good. And it's so stupid that we have been planning to blow them up.
You were talking about running for president once. If you did that, what would be your main platform? What would be one of the first things you'd want to do?
Get rid of all the bad laws. Stop producing lawyers. Because you will never have a situation in the United States where people can rely on justice as long as you have the quantity of lawyers perverting the justice system that you have now. Because a lawyer can't earn a dollar unless he's engaged in some sort of legal pursuit. He's got to sue somebody. Yeah. And when you fill up the courts with the type of legal actions that are, I use the term rather loosely, legal actions that take place in U.S. courts, it reduces the chances of anybody getting justice for his cause. It's not about justice, it's only about money. And until somebody does something about that, you can't really have law and order in a country. It's stupid to talk about hiring more policemen to go out and arrest more people because they're going to go through our legal system, which is a disaster. It's a disaster area. Mm. And then all they can talk about is building more and larger prisons.
Yeah.
We have more people in prison in this country than anybody else in the world. It's a major industry. They even have privatized prisons here where you can opt for being locked up in, your own little country club prison. Everything is distorted as far as justice goes in this country. Mm-hmm. And you can't send kids to school and tell them, home of the free and the brave and liberty and justice for all.
Yeah.
And expect them to grow up believing that. And then when the first time they've got to go down and deal with a traffic ticket or any confrontation with the legal system in this country, they're just going to go, who's kidding who? I'll be a crook. Because the crooks are having a good time.
Well, the delineation between the people who are caught and who are not seems to be rather fuzzy.
Well, there's another one of my theories which is expressed in the Joe's Garage album, which is the theory of total criminalization. Mm-hmm. One way of holding the society together is if everybody is a crook, you could be a crook. You just don't know it yet because you've probably violated some law. And if you look at all these regulations, censorship and all the rest of that stuff, it makes it even easier to be criminalized. And when you're a crook, and to some degree, then you can be blackmailed. Yeah. Not just by a regular blackmailer, but by the government itself. Because there's always the possibility, that something bad will happen to you because you committed one of these pseudo-crimes. You didn't want to be a crook, but you didn't know. The reason you didn't know, they can't update the school books fast enough to tell you.
Yes, the point you were making before about the lawyers in this country, it's already
disastrous.
It is. To me, it's particularly evident because it is so litigious here. Mm-hmm. It frightens me. I mean, I'm actually frightened that something will go wrong and I will become embroiled in the legal process.
That's right.
And I know that it's basically a meat grinder.
Absolutely.
What concerns me in Australia is that the very people who lead us are from either the legal field, that is, they were lawyers, or in the case of our equivalent of the Republicans, the Liberal Party, they're either lawyers or ex-real estate agents.
Mm-hmm.
Is that pretty much the case here? Because that would make it seem rather hopeless.
Well, here we have either lawyers or used car dealers.
The same thing.
Well, we have some real estate agents too. But that's basically what they are.
Because it seems to me that lawyers who get into positions of power are more inclined to want to look after themselves and their friends than
well,
they are.
It takes a special kind of lawyer, you see, because if a guy is a good lawyer, why should he go into politics? He can make a fortune suing people. It's only the bad lawyers,
yes.
the ones who can't make the big bucks in the private sector,
yes.
that wind up doing this other kind of work.
Mm.
And then it's when it. There's a difference between being the draftsman of a law and being the litigator of a law.
Yes.
If you've been a lawyer and all your life you knew what was in the book and you go out and sue people, that's one thing. But to write a law yourself, I think that should be a very specialized kind of a thing. So
yes.
a guy becomes a lawyer and then he goes into the Congress, how is he really equipped to write law?
Yeah.
That's a big responsibility. Now, there's already more laws in the books than anybody even knows about, the tax law especially. There's no one man in the U.S. that anyone can point to and say, he knows what's in the tax code. You can't. It changes all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost weekly. The accountants subscribe to a computer service where adjustments in the existing tax law come in.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is in flux. You're standing on quicksand.
I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yes,
so it's an amorphous thing that just
it's
sort of
an amorphous
around.
Thing. That's right. And each different division of the tax law is a specialty. And each specialty is changing with different instructions to the law. And every time a case is decided in a court, the outcome of the case has an impact on the existing law. Because if you go to challenge the law, you have to deal with case law. In other words, one of the ways you decide who wins is, has it ever been decided before, and what happened then? You have to look at the case, see? So, every time a new case is decided, it impacts on the law, and it's like this amoeba that just keeps growing and growing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's an individual citizen with good intentions is hopelessly ill-equipped to deal with 20th century America. Let alone 21st century America, because you can't know what the law is.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about the Ten Commandments.
Mm-hmm.
It's about instructions to the law,
yes.
loopholes, mm-hmm. ways to beat it, and all this kind of mm-hmm. stuff. And that's where the lawyers come in. If you have the money, you can hire somebody to help you beat the law.
Yes.
Not, and then after he's beaten the law, okay, he's going to go in and write some stupid law, but while he's writing, he's already thinking of, you know, the way to write it to build defects into it. Because there's always a loophole that's going to be valuable to somebody. Now, he's the guy who drafted the law, and he knows where the hook is. Then maybe there's a way for him to make some bucks on the side, you know, as a consultant after he leaves government.
That's a new scam, isn't it? Everyone's a consultant now, all the old crooks.
Yeah, well, that happens in Australia too.
Yes.
Well, that means that if anybody, you know, who works in the tax department
mm-hmm.
or is a tax lawyer actually cares about doing their job properly, they're gonna have a really hard time. They're gonna get ulcers. They're going to
be defeated.
Yeah.
First of all, the IRS, Internal Revenue Service, that collects tax in the United States, the pay scale is so low for the people who come in at an entry level. That an entry-level job in the private sector pays twice as much, maybe 2.5 times as much, as the government pays for an entry-level auditor.
So the people, discouragement.
Well, yeah. But, you know, suppose you can't get a job anyplace else and you're a bad accountant. You can always go to work for the IRS, which means you're going in there and you're botching everybody else's taxes. Now, this bad accountant at an entry-level position is interpreting tax law that no one can understand, and you as a taxpayer, you don't know what to do with your form. You go in there and you have to ask this guy a question.
Mm-hmm.
Now he can ruin your life.
And he doesn't know.
He doesn't know.
Much less care.
But he's got, you know, a quota to fill. He's got to crank these things out. So it's a mess. It's a total mess.
Mm.
There has to be something done to change the way in which taxes are collected. It has to be something done to change the reason why taxes are collected. I mean, I resent the idea that the bulk of what I earn is going to buy weapons that I don't want to see anybody use.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just stupid.
Mm.
in the end, you've got to keep finding markets to sell these weapons.
Or wars where you can use enough of them yourself. Yeah. I mean,
has there ever been a weapon that hasn't been used?
Well, the problem is we have a big pile of them that they don't use them.
Well, they're going to.
And they're going to. I can't see a peaceful way out of the Middle East because after, imagine what happens to Bush's reputation, the man who lives in fear of being called a wimp. If he brings those guys home without shooting at something, he's dead.
Yeah, and he wants to be a hero. Well, the computer speech you use for the Crabgrass Baby on Thinkfish, which is one of my favourite albums, have you got much of that material? And if so, do you intend on using that sort of stuff a lot more?
No, all I did was I prepared that just for that album.
Just for that album?
Yeah. Mm. There are rules that you have to abide by when you're preparing that. I think it can only be 17 words, and then you have to hit a carriage return, and there's some little something that happened. I can't remember all the rules now, but it took a while to prepare that.
Yeah, was that one of your most difficult albums to put together?
Oh, Thinkfish, that was very complicated.
Great album, though.
Well, I'm surprised that you guys like it. Most people don't know that album, and I always thought that it was one of my best albums conceptually. I think that
it's fabulous.
It's really kind of neat, but to understand it, most people, they would have to know about Amos and Andy, and they would have
Being Australians, you're enabled to get a rounder view of the rest of the world because...
It's all shipped in.
Yeah,
well, it
is. It's forced.
You're familiar with Noam Chomsky.
Yeah.
Well, his view is that there are basically places outside of England, some of Europe and America, which are just considered so unimportant, it doesn't matter what shit you tell them, what can they do with it? So we get it all. You just turn on the television, everyone tells you the truth. And, well, what do you do about it? You go out and buy a new car and you go to work.
Yes, it's too bad. I could have had a good time down there. And I think with that I got to wrap it up.
Okay,
great.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, excellent. Oh, there is...
Yeah, thank you.
There is a... Oh, thank you very much, Trent.
Yeah, we bought you some gifts, by the way.
Okay.
Knowing that you like peanut butter, there's some Australian peanut butter.
Is this it?
Yeah.
This is the good stuff?
Well...
Super crunchy, huh? All right.
Super crunchy. And I don't know whether you ever tried this.
Vegemite, no.
Vegemite.
Oh, my God.
Now, that's important. You need instructions of that.
What do you do with it?
If you put it on like jelly, it's going to taste like shit.
Uh-huh.
I mean, really, you know, you're going to be vomiting.
Yeah.
You've got to put butter onto some butter or margarine onto bread, and you put the merest smear, like a molecular smear all over the surface of the butter.
Molecular sheen.
Yeah. And then you chew, and that's important.
It's good.
Is
it? It's good stuff. I like it.
And there's a book from an Australian band who is very amusing, and we were unable to bring along either the CD or the cassette owing to the suddenness of this happening. But, we'll mail it to you.
One.
Okay.
But that's the book. It's got strange lyrics. They're a very amusing band. And they do reasonably well, and they draw the wrong crowd, but they're fun.
They draw the wrong
crowd. Well, basically, it's teenagers.
Martin Scorsese is really quite a jovial fellow.
That's a nice song.
Well, I tell you. Tism congratulates the worker. This is good stuff.
Tism stands for "This is serious, Mum." But they play masked, so they're all unknown.
Although they give their names and full addresses in the
it's just one of those incongruities one can never explain.
From Tism to Fotis X.
Yeah, there's some intelligence in there.
Are you familiar with this Bob religion?
Yeah, I've become quite familiar with it in the last week.
Yeah, there's some really good Bob writings somebody sent me. Some good stuff.
Some of that's very amusing.
Yeah, I like that book. What is it? The Book of the Subgenius. That is hilarious. The idea of the headless golfer Jesus.
That's a great concept.
I didn't see that in there.
That's a good one.
Gail read me some big chunk of it the other day that I thought it was hilarious. I didn't know about the headless doll for Jesus.
Mm. You want to see the studio?
Oh, I'd love to. That'd be great. I just have the kill switch on this.